Welcome once again to another fantastic episode of the Business Creators Radio Show. We help business creators like you win at the game of business and marketing so you can thrive from your intersection of your brilliance and your passion and make a difference for your community, market, and audience. Please take a moment and visit our website, www.businesscreatorsradioshow.com. You'll find hundreds of episodes covering a breadth and depth of topics relevant to you as a business creator, and links to subscribe via your favorite network so you get fresh episodes delivered straight to you. And now, here's today's episode. Let's get started.
My name is Adam Homey. I am your host, and I am honored by your wise decision once again to tune in and invest in yourself today. And the canine population of the world is rejoicing as we dive into another episode of the Business Creators Radio Show. We are a podcast that takes you to those places where you have those mastermind meetings and aha moments that can change your trajectory or at least bring you a little bit closer to your intersection of your brilliance and your passion. We don't have a $25,000 Hollywood studio. In fact, I'm sitting out here on my balcony here in beautiful Las Vegas, known to some on some days as the hottest city in America. It's a nice, beautiful 98-degree day, which in Las Vegas is not even hot because we don't really have much humidity, enjoying a cigar, enjoying the view, and occasionally you may hear some things in the background. The leaf blower guys are out there clearing our non-existent leaves, and Harry Reid Airport is about 3 miles behind me, so occasionally may you hear a helicopter or the whoosh of a 747. But these are the things you hear in the background when you are having those transformational conversations. They do not happen in sterile soundproof rooms. So imagine yourself being the third person sitting in on a private mastermind conversation, capturing those aha moments. Well, in this case, the fourth person, because we have two people here today. Their names are Mark Petruzzi and Paul Melchiori. They were on my other podcast several weeks ago, and I invited them back because I realized that we had a lot more to discuss than we could cover in just 15 minutes. Their topic is about selling the cloud, and that's the title of their book. So we're going to take a deep dive into what it takes to be successful in selling cloud software today. And we're going to go beyond just cloud software. We're going to go into some areas of sales in general. We're going to cover a couple hot button topics, a couple live wires. This is really one you want to be leaned into and tuned into. And you want to subscribe to our show so that you can go back and get the replay and listen to this a few times, as just from the sample we got from Mark and Paul a few weeks ago, I can tell you this one is going to be a feast. Mark and Paul, come on in. The weather's fine.
Awesome. Thanks for having us, Adam.
Absolutely.
Hey, Adam, how are you?
Fantastic. Couldn't be better if you paid me $1 million, but try it once anyway, just to see what happens. I'm a big believer in scientific experiments and testing hypotheses. So what we like to do here is, you both have very impressive biographies, which can be found on our website. In fact, I'm not sure I'm worthy to be here in your presence, and this is my show. So rather than me read off the bios, which anybody can look up, I want you guys to just take a few moments and tell me a bit about your journey and what's brought you to where you are today, serving business creators from your intersection of your brilliance and your passion. Bearing in mind, we have a different set of listeners than we had for the last show.
Paul, take us away.
Well, Mark, you're older. I was going to have you go first, but I guess I'll start. This is Paul Melchiori, and thank you, Adam. We're really appreciative to be part of this event today. And, you know, my career started way back here in the city of Philadelphia when a small company called SAP decided to migrate from Germany to the U.S. So I was fortunate enough to be one of the very first employees as that company expanded internationally. And as you can imagine, it was a rocket ship ride from the beginning. You know, in the late 80s, early 90s, SAP was probably one of the most successful stories in software, especially for a European company coming to the U.S. And I think today it's the equivalent GDP of a mid-sized country. So yeah. It was an incredible run through those 90s. And then I was able to leverage that to go to a startup company in California, did my first tour of duty there, a company called Ariba, pre-revenue B2B e-procurement company. And then was there pretty much almost from beginning pre-revenue through to the sale, ironically, of Aribatus SAP. Did a small stint at a private equity owned firm called iPipeline. And then more recently joined Anaplan early on and took them public. And now currently doing private equity venture growth work for a company called Stripes.
Okay.
Awesome. Fantastic. I'll jump in as well, Adam. I'm fortunate to have a very close friend and co-author who doesn't add really well than when he tries to figure out who's older, but we'll start from there. So I joined Paul early in those days from an SAP perspective. I was a director and then managing director at Deloitte. Was fortunate enough to start a couple boutique consulting firms and then worked with Mark Benioff and a number of his individuals who went off to start Salesforce when they were still at Oracle. So certainly right place, right time a few times in my career. Moved into SaaS in the cloud. Kind of the message from Mark when he left was, you know, anybody he knew at a boutique consulting background kind of showed up on a list where they were like, the message was, you know, we're about to do something really, really big with Salesforce and with the cloud. And, you know, frankly, you're not very smart if you don't resign from Oracle, you know, like that day and start a Salesforce.com boutique. And it took me about 3 years. So I guess I'm not as smart as I sometimes hope I am. Early into the cloud and a very balanced focus on the cloud software SaaS side and consulting side. And that's when I've got the real opportunities to work with Paul and some of the other most amazing CROs that we have had in this tech space. And that helped us to do a couple things. For me, it allows me to work with BCG and Genpak and other companies as an expert advisor and board advisor. That allows me to work with some of the most successful large SaaS companies that are out there today and do sales transformation and sales consulting. And it also gives me the bandwidth too to work with a lot of smaller companies in an advisory and board position. And do a lot of work with private equity, you know, similar to what Paul does with Stripes. But really what that's given me is I've gotten to, you know, work with, coordinate, collaborate, and watch, as I mentioned, you know, individuals like Paul do their things. And it's a real treat. And I've actually taken a few things I've learned along the way and, you know, moved into some senior sales leadership CRO roles myself. So really happy to be here with you, Adam. And I love having my partner here, Paul, on, even though he's older than me.
I was going to say something about age before beauty, but then again, I can't tell which is which. I think we're all just fantastic guys. Now, Paul, I have a quick question. Actually, I think it was Mark. When I look at your bios, actually, I often can't tell which is which because you both mentioned Paul. I think it was Paul. So correct me if I'm wrong. You mentioned that you worked for Ariba.
Correct.
That's Paul.
Within what time frame was that?
So I was fortunate enough, as like I said, to join their pre-revenue. So when I left SAP late 97, early 98, actually packed up, moved out of Philadelphia to go to California. So I was with Ariba pretty much from that time frame all the way up to the sale to SAP, which occurred in 2012.
Okay. Well, that's okay. The reason I bring that up is I started my MBA program in September of the year 2000 when I started Duquesne University. And for a few weeks during that first semester, I had a temp job at a company called Free Markets, which anybody who works at Ariba has probably heard of. And some of our listeners know why, but I'm about to tell you. During the 3 weeks that I was a temp there, I came away with the impression that this was a chaotic company, basically pulling it off, basically pulling it out of its ass. It was going to get acquired within 2 to 3 years. I didn't know nothing for nothing as far as business logistics or development at that point, but even I could figure out this company was going to be acquired by a competitor. Now, fast forward about a semester or two to a class I had at Duquesne. It was our environment of business class. Each week the professor would have some luminary from the local business community come in and give a 30-minute presentation. Well, one week we had the HR director from Ariba, and the next week we had the manager of people development, whatever title he used, who worked with Free Markets. When I compared the two presentations, I said, Ariba will buy Free Markets within 3 years. Watch.
You were a visionary, Adam. In fact, it was a great acquisition. I think we acquired them in the height of the, I guess, depression of 2004-05, where we almost got delisted for $400 million in, you know, equity. And I think we sold it to Accenture like 3 or 4 years later for like $68 million. So needless to say, the mathematics didn't work out. And you predicted that very, very well. So the good news is we were able to relocate a lot of very expensive jobs in California to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. So it worked out good for me. It was a lot easier trip to go from Philly to Pittsburgh than to get back and forth to Cali. So.
Well, yeah, obviously based on the story I told you, I lived in Pittsburgh at the time, and I used to, when I first became an entrepreneur, my first three clients were all in the Philadelphia area. So I used to drive out there back and forth every 60 days. Plus my best friend from college lives in the environs of Jackson, New Jersey. So I used to road trip out there about once a quarter and vice versa.
Well, so if you come out here, you're more than welcome, Adam. We'll host you here in Philly.
Okay. Yeah. Hey, next time in the area, we'll absolutely have to hang out. So you guys are the authors of the book Selling the Cloud, a playbook for success in cloud software and enterprise sales. So I'm going to start with a very broad question and we're going to narrow it. What inspired you guys to write the book in the first place?
Yeah, I'll take an initial run at it. Yeah. Well, Mark made it. Well, I made Paul do it, but it started over a lunch or a dinner where we were just talking about crazy things at the beginning of, the pandemic was kind of about to kick in. And we kind of knew it at the time. When it came down to it, we just looked at this as saying, okay, you know, maybe things will slow down a little bit. For a while with this. By the way, for both Paul and me, it didn't slow down one bit, which makes writing a book a little harder. But we were thinking maybe it would, and said, if we're going to ever write a book and we're ever going to get back to younger versions of ourselves, this is the way to do it. But the idea was all about giving back, and even giving back from a charitable perspective and all that. We've been very fortunate to be able to sell many, many more books than we ever thought we would. And that means better charity donations at the end of the year. And I can spend all my time just trying to support all the great things that Paul does from a charitable perspective. So yeah, it was to give back, and we've gotten to give back in a couple of ways, which we love.
Certainly. So this is about SaaS sales, which stands for software as a service. Now, how do those types of sales differ from other type of B2B sales?
You know, let me try that one, Mark. And that's a great question, because I think when we started this approach, we had like books of notes and, you know, ideas, and it was all about what we had done, you know, in selling primarily to, you know, the enterprise and selling software. But when we started thinking about through it, if you go through each of the chapters, we started to realize, look, this isn't just about selling software or just about selling business to business software or SaaS software. A lot of these principles, Adam, that we felt were really fundamental aspects of selling complex products or services, regardless of industry, regardless of, you know, whether it was software, hardware, or whatever. So I think it really started that way. And of course, our title, and because our backgrounds are all around SaaS software and selling the cloud. But I really think, and we've gotten the feedback that, you know, if you go through each one of these chapters, fundamentally, each of these concepts apply to selling anything that's complex, that deals with relationships, that deals with complexity, dealing with complex organizations, whether it's hardware, software, services, really anything. But I think it had a slant on selling software in a B2B environment or cloud-based SaaS software. But I really think it's more, you know, broad than that and has a much more broader appeal.
Okay. Yeah, I was just, and part of the reason I wanted to speak with you guys in the first place is that, you know, we're seeing in today's marketplace the explosion of artificial intelligence and how this is being translated into the development of products and services that could be viewed as SaaS. In fact, one of my clients, I can't say anything right now because of NDAs, is working on two separate artificial intelligence coaching applications that are geared to two specific niches that they work in. And we have one of our Podcast Reach clients who has actually developed a life coaching or self-help coaching application based on artificial intelligence. And that in a way falls under the SaaS category, I believe, as well. So I believe this is actually going to become more relevant, not less, as we go along.
Yeah, Adam, and I think you're right on the money with that. And we tried to stay ahead of the curve there too. And we have a book coming out, another book coming out that is all focused on the data side, the sales tech, and the AI side, for how as a good sales leader, you know, how you can really leverage the capabilities that are out there from a technology standpoint. And that title is going to be Diagnosis and Data Driven Selling. And it's taking all these concepts on another level. So we're real excited about that as well. But to comment on AI and technology, you know, there is you're exactly right that this, you know, even though we focused it on SaaS, it expands really quickly to what Paul and I believe every bit of selling should be. And what I mean by that is, you know, when you look at what happened in our software space, software was typically sold at an SAP, at an Oracle, for, you know, an initial check of $2 million, $5 million, $15 million, $20 million. And what would happen then, that check would be written, and then the consulting teams of those organizations would come in and try to piece this all together, and support and all the other components. And frankly, the sales team was forced to move on. They had to go find the next 10 or 15 deals like this. So they disappeared. And that's one thing that Mark Benioff and individuals like Scott Scher, who's the founder of Ultimate Software, now UKG, that's what they figured out, that's not a good long model. And you're gonna make a lot of clients really unhappy with that kind of an approach. And they looked at this being more subscription-based, more commitment-based on both the vendor and client side. And guess what? What has happened with that, instead of these companies rotating out, even though it would take immense fixed cost to rip out a system and implement it again, they'd still, within 7-10 years, they'd rip it out and they'd take it on the chin and they'd be so happy to get rid of whatever incumbent vendor they have. Now there are companies, you know, like Salesforce, that have had the same clients for now 18, 20, 21 years. And all they have to do is have a different model of selling and a different level of commitment to their clients. And Paul and I both believe this has been a game changer. It's why these companies are so highly valued. And to your point, it's why AI, it's the framework where AI is going to be driven as well, because it's the same thing. Whether it's, you know, you're down the road signing up for a business version of ChatGPT or whatever else comes next, you're gonna keep writing those subscription checks if you're getting the kind of power and response that these AI tools are able to give. So I think you're right. It's just going to get bigger and better.
Yeah, what I was thinking of as you were saying that, and you know, you companies bring in these sophisticated SaaS systems or technologies that they use to run a significant portion of their business. But there's something else that changes in the company typically every 5 to 7 years, which is the makeup of the C-suite. And what we often see happen, at least from my outside looking in experience, and you tell me what you think of this, is part of the reason you will have these things happen where they'll rip out an entire system and have a competitor or a different company put in a whole new system is that there's a new sheriff in town and they want to show that they're making a difference and implementing change.
Yeah, yeah, I'll tell Paul, you, Adam, this is Paul. I think that's one of the
So if I made my follow-up question, I forgot to mention my follow-up question. My apologies is how do you, what do you put in place to resist that impulse?
Well, you know, it's interesting because as new management comes into any situation, that typically requires change. And the reason new management's coming in is because the old management probably wasn't getting it done. So there's going to be change management, change in technology, different systems. Mm-hmm. And I think what's happened in the old SAP days, you couldn't rip and replace. It was like taking the organs of a body out. You just don't do it. It's as the technology embedded into Fortune companies that I sold almost 30 years ago. So, and it's not coming out, which is probably why we have the supply chain problems we have. But regardless, the SaaS environment allows companies to rip and replace, if you will, or augment technologies without having kind of surgery, if you will. So you can put these SaaS technologies in relatively quickly, you know, not in, you know, years, but in weeks or months. And therefore, as these new management transitions occur, the new change in direction or strategy occur, then you have an ability to put these technologies in quickly, which is why, as Mark said, it's very important to have that level of customer success and serviceability, because you're only paying, say, a year, 2 years, maybe a three-year contract, and then it has to renew, just like a subscription of any kind. And therefore, it's very important. But I do agree, when you have these changes in management, changes in strategy, or whatever, this new element of software, and I think it's only going to get more complex when you think about AI, which has kind of been around, if you will, for a while. I mean, we've been running algorithms and techniques in these companies to do predictive analytics and forecasting and other aspects of any kind of predictive modeling. It's now just become almost more mainstream when you hear about, you know, consumer-based products like ChatGPT and others, but it's been around forever. I mean, think about it. Every time you go on Amazon or you go on any of these products, I mean, Amazon knows that your wife's pregnant before, you know, you or she does, right? So this technology has been around and it's been working forever, and it knows what, you know, ads to serve you up based on your prior, you know, browsing history. So this technology is now just leapfrogging, and I think it will be a dramatic shift and change in a lot of companies, and some companies will, you know, embrace it and take advantage of it, and others will be left behind without question.
Okay. Yeah. And speaking of algorithms, I mean, I'm just, I have a few tabs open on my browser as we do this big surprise. Right. And so right now I'm thumbing through my Facebook while we're having this conversation, looking at some of the entries in my Everything Podcasting group, because we're having our weekly roundup. And I just happened to, you know, meander onto the news feed while I was listening, hanging on every word you said. And I bet you before the end of our time here, I'm going to be getting ads for midwives and doulas. And awesome. And the fact I just said out loud pretty much locked it in at this point. Yeah, so
Alexa and Siri are always listening.
I don't have those types of devices where I just ask it to do something for me, but I have no doubt in my mind that pretty much every appliance except my refrigerator, which is an old school refrigerator, are probably listening to every word I say.
Hey, Adam, one thing we just touched on that I'd like to bring out a little bit further as well. You know, it's funny, to the points that Paul was making, that 5 to 7 year rotation of a new executive team. What's really cool, though, about this SaaS space You know, as Paul mentioned, when a new executive team came in and 5 or 7 or 10 years later, they go and they wanted to rip out that supply chain system. And it would be so painful and so costly. But the client-vendor relationship was typically so bad that although the CFO never wanted to see that money spent, they couldn't stop it. You know, if somebody came in as a CEO. But nowadays, what I see in a lot of my clients is the process starts the same way. A new sheriff comes in and they're like, I don't like this system. I wanted that system. But then the CFO gets involved and finds out everybody kind of likes this system. It's not so bad. There's work to do. There's add-ons, like Paul said, but it's not what it used to be. And that's what stops the actual plug being pulled. And that I think is a really, really cool thing. And, you know, Paul and I, you know, we still to this day have passion for that. We love that, you know, we can do this stuff for our clients and, you know, it's never easy. And, you know, there's always challenges with any kind of software, but man, oh man, the difference of what our clients think about with us and how happy they are with these software systems today versus 15 or 20 years ago is night and day.
Well, here's a micro thing I thought of. Now, I've been a guy who's owned multiple computers for most of my adult life, and I'm used to the idea of I start a new computer and then I have to install all my critical softwares on it so that I can basically have redundancy to do all the functions of my business, yada 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 yada, you know the rest. So I love the PC environments. I've mostly had Samsungs, and lately I've developed a real attachment for the Lenovo Yogas. My smartphones have always been either Samsungs or Google Pixel, this, that, or the other. And I swear to God, it's almost cult-like. I remember one time on my 2013 Samsung, when the thing was 6 years old, the power cord got frayed just from daily use. And I mentioned on social media that I had had to go to an aftermarket place and pay $32 to get the cord because Samsung no longer manufactured it. And boy, how many people tried to tell me that the solution to that problem was to get a Mac? Well, here's one of the arguments that folks used to be able to make about that as well. With my MacBook, if one machine dies, I just get another one and I open it up, I turn the power on, I connect it to the internet, I push one button, and it replicates my entire desktop from the other one. And here in 2023, I can say, yeah, cool. When my one Lenovo Yoga's keyboard stopped working and I had to take it in for repairs under warranty, but I couldn't wait 10 days to get it back. I had to buy another Lenovo Yoga that day. I brought it home and I did the same thing. So at the micro level, we're seeing a lot more of this as well. I remember back in the day where every 3 years you had to buy a new Microsoft Office because the previous one became defunct. And now you just pay $99 a year and you always have the most current version. You don't even realize it's being updated. And that's with a lot of softwares. I mean, I can start a new computer and be fully up to speed in 15 minutes. So, and I think we're seeing that in a lot of things, and I think that's an opportunity. This is actually a question for you. This is an opportunity. Once you get that client and you get your SaaS, your cloud software into their systems, that one of the things that protects your retention of that customer is the ability to quickly add new features and have them installed via the cloud.
Yeah. Hey, this is Paul. I'll tell you that the innovation cycles with this type of delivery vehicle is really what is the difference. And so when you have kind of the legacy technologies, and there's so many of them out there, and they're still out there, ironically, but you know, they are being replaced and slowly being replaced. And once they are replaced, the new technologies from the SaaS providers that come in, you know, really do allow that ongoing innovation. So release cycles used to be once a year. And when you went through a release of an SAP or an Oracle, it was a very painful process. And, you know, the product wasn't that much better and you went through a lot of pain to get to the next release. Now, you know, you don't even know that the next release has come up. It just appears. That's really the difference.
Yeah. And yeah, and I think that that's fantastic. So let's say that you're a salesperson for a company, and it's, you're getting a lot of demand for this one feature. Well, they can, as I understand it, they can add it to their software and then just push it out through the next update. Sort of like the way that Tesla can update the software in their cars. They just push the update sometimes, and depending on what it is, like, you know, again, coming back to the PC computers, I remember back in the day where if you had to system restore your machine and the machine was like 3 years old, first you system restored it, then you had to wait almost another day for all of the patches and updates to catch up. Whereas in today's environment, that still happens, but it takes like 10 minutes.
Exactly.
Yeah, so there have been a lot of developments there. Now, here's an intriguing question, and given the demographics of my listeners, this is something that I know that a number of our listeners are curious about. You've mentioned, and we discussed this briefly in the green room, that that women in particular can excel in this area of sales. And why do you say that?
Yeah, I'll jump on that one first.
Yeah.
They're better than us.
But there's a few things on another podcast just a couple of days ago. We went very deep into this, and let me tell you, there's a few really simple reasons, and the simplest is they're better. So that's one thing. But let's go a little deeper. Their empathy is different. It's different, and it's better than I think, and you know, we think. Typically, you know, a typical guy has. So they are, whether it's a long-term relationship or just a meeting, they can take themselves easier into, you know, looking at it from the other individual's perspective, the client or prospect's perspective. So that's one thing. Then it's the authenticity. You know, we believe that women are better at being their authentic self on average than men. Now there's examples that go off of that chart on each side, but that's another thing. And then the third thing I always kind of tie this to, kind of ties back to the better point, you know, women are smarter as a whole. And okay. you could prove it out from a data perspective by just looking at the percentage of female versus male students in every college, you know, throughout America, and even some of the best ones have significant differences on that. Now, there's other reasons why that happened and everything else, but I think that you know, that pure brain power combined with the empathy and the authenticity are three of the major issues. Paul, anything to add to that?
Yeah, I'd say if you go into chapter 5, I believe it's empathy and selling the cloud, that we talked all about that. And it really drove home, you know, and we had great examples. In my most recent, you know, role at Anaplan, you know, when I got there, some of the top reps, they were all female. In fact, I had this poor guy, Tom, call me up at the end of the year, and he thought he had, you know, won the Porsche, which I used to give out every year to the top rep. And I said, yeah, Tom, I said, you're the top rep. And he says, really? Am I getting the Porsche? I said, oh, no, you're sixth overall. You're the top male rep. The first five are females. And it was sad, but true. I mean, I felt bad for the poor guy, but that's just the way it worked. And I think through our careers, we started to see it. Now, the numbers haven't really equated, you know, because they're still in our profession in technology and selling, I think in general in technology, there's still very many more, you know, males versus females. But you know, the numbers are definitely trending in the right direction. And I think, as Mark says, because of the reasons, you know, they should really be involved more in tech and be involved more in tech selling, because, you know, they definitely have a much better chance of success. And I think you'll see those numbers over the next decade really almost go in the opposite direction, in my opinion.
Yeah, see, I knew when I asked the question that this would come across a little edgy. In fact, you may recall at the beginning of the introduction, I said that we were going to touch a couple live wires, this is what I had in mind. And you know, the fact is, you know, there are both strengths and weaknesses, opportunities and challenges, whether you're male or whether you're female, and you do bring different things to the table. I say there are certain things that that women are innately superior to me. There's things that they can't, that I couldn't possibly dream of doing. And then I'm going beyond giving birth. There are other physical, mental, and other capabilities as well. And anybody who's married or in a relationship knows that winning arguments is typically something you want the woman to do. Yeah. So, that was absolutely evil and rotten of me, but hey, it's my platform, so I don't care. At the same time, the male of the species brings certain things to us as well. And I don't really view it so much as competition or, looking at pluses and minuses, but I look at it more as what can we gain through synergy.
Well, Adam, yeah, I mean, that's all diversity, right? We need all that in every single way. And it's funny, I don't know if you noticed that when you really went deep on this whole male-female thing, I actually muted myself to make sure I didn't get into your discussion. But because you're this whole winning argument thing, you're going to get in trouble for that one. But point being,
you're right, dear. I'm sorry, dear. I know I'm not currently married, but I have actually done well enough that I've reached the M discussion twice in my life.
There you go.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. And again, I won't take this into a whole diversity thing about, it's not what this context is. But from our perspective and in this book, I mean, the diversity is huge. It's everything. And it's the diversity of thought, background, every single thing you can do as a sales team. And we even have, again, a chapter that we really analyze kind of the standardized different types of sales reps. There are five or six different categories.
Tell us a bit about this. This is my next question.
Awesome. So yeah, I mean, it's when it comes down to that, there are different types. There are the ones that are very, calculated in everything they do and very quantitative and very data focused. And, you have those individuals, and then you have the ones that are just really, more relationship, and they don't want to get into process in a deep, deep way. And you know what? What we, we've spent a lot of our careers kind of figuring out, well, what do we need more of, and what's better, and what wins more? And we've looked at all that, and a lot of what I've seen in the data that I've worked with is, as much as there are certainly trends, there is no unequivocal trends. So you cannot say, I want all my people to look this way, or I want all my people to have this kind of a mindset, or even selling style. And you should, make sure, and this is the simplest way that I do it, that you try to add as much diversity in every single way you can. And if you take it in that simple way, you will have the best sales team you can build. That's how it's worked for me, at least.
Yeah. Hey, it's a team sport, and no team has all the same players. And, diversity is maybe the right or wrong word, because people use it in a lot of different ways, and we don't mean it in the traditional political like way. It's right. Different types of people bring different types of skill sets. Teams mesh together because they have different personalities. I mean, we talk in the book about the types of salespeople, and there's different types of profiles, if you will. And if you look at any great sales team, first of all, if you're a giant company like a Salesforce or an SAP or an Oracle, you can't have all of the same type, right? But together they mix and match those diverse profiles, diverse personalities. And then, it's a team sport as it is. It's not just the sales rep. It's the pre-sales. It's the engineer. It's the customer support rep. It's the product management folks. It's all the people working together. And typically, if you have diversity of thought, if you will, and that goes all the way up to the boardroom, right? When you look at boards being constructed, it's the diversity of thought, not necessarily a diversity that people think about that really makes those management teams or boards really execute well.
Yeah. You know, there's a quote that I like to paraphrase, and I say paraphrase because I might be off by one point, but you'll get the gist of it. It was from General George S. Patton, and he's and what's attributed to him is him saying that if everybody in the room is thinking the same way, somebody isn't thinking.
You're right. That's a good one.
Now there's something interesting about his management and leadership style when it came to the various commanders and officers who reported to him. He was a stickler for certain things, the way you language certain things in conversations. He demanded absolute conformity when it came to perfection in uniforms, for example. However, he did not actually micromanage his battles, and he expected his field commanders to be able to think and act independently without having to call him for instructions every single time the bullets started flying. Now, to deconstruct this very briefly, what he was creating was a culture where this is how we look, this is how we act, this is how we think. And in creating this, I'm giving you the framework for what we view as the best practices. And with this, I'm now counting on you to be able to apply it to real-time situations innovatively and with agility as they come up. And I've always thought that that's, to a degree, a pretty good way of doing things in the main. Demanding absolute conformity may or may not work depending on the culture of the workplace and the culture of the industry, but being able to articulate that type of vision, mission, and goals and getting people to embrace it actually in a way empowers them, because they will, in real-time situations, be able to make decisions and take actions that they can feel confident will have the backing of superiors who they'll be counting on for sponsorship on this, even when they didn't have an opportunity to consult to get the sponsorship.
Yeah, we're moving too fast. You're right. You have to have that kind of a framework. And, you know, the military is always a good example because, you know, you can always relate it to business in some ways, other than people don't, you know, get in as much trouble. And I've never seen anybody in software die on the job, if you will, per se. But, you know, the pressure is the same, right? I mean, you're in a large transaction, you're, you know, chasing a big client, you don't have room for error, and you have to make sure you're empowering. As I said, it's a team sport. So putting that framework together, having that leadership style to empower the people on the team to make the right decisions, it's almost, you know, the only way it can happen in today's fast-paced world.
Yeah, and here's another thing. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. All I was just going to add to that is just it's amazing how often you don't see that happen. And what I mean by that is you have CROs, people who have competed against Paul, and Paul has run circles around them for years, that, you know, just they look to drive as much conformity as they could. And they thought they had this right recipe, and they wanted everyone just to use it. And even to the extent, I mean, there's so many of these. I mean, we can write a book on this. There's so many examples of sales leaders that only wanted their sales team to take a deal a certain level, and then they wanted to jump in and close the last, you know, the last 10 days or whatever it is. Not a two-minute meeting where they close. They wanted it now. It was a real deal. They now saw it, and they would grab it, put their arms around it, kind of totally neutralize the sales rep. And they would go to do that. And, you know, guess what? That may serve you for a week. It doesn't serve you for any period of time longer than that. And that's where great sales leaders like someone like Paul or Jim Steele from Salesforce or Matt Radman from Workday, you know, great sales leaders that support their people and enable them, give them some process when it's helpful and productive, but man, oh man, you got to enable and support your team, or you're never going to get to the numbers that these three individuals, Paul included, have gotten through their whole career.
Yeah. And I think a perfect example of that is every prospect and every client is different. So you guys speak about diversity in your teams. Well, it may, from my understanding anyway, go to the level of you want to pair certain types of sales reps with certain types of prospects because you have your greatest chance of synergy and success. So that's something you want to try and keep in mind. Also, to bear in mind that every client is different. I know in my business, through my work with entrepreneurs, helping them launch your podcast, every single one of these clients is different. And I can tell you that they run the gamut of styles of thought processes and everything else. I mean, I may jump in the morning. I'm dealing with one client who really, really loves to look under the hood of how the podcast works and all the technical details. And then 2 hours later, I'm with another client and their primary concern is, well, how do I get 100 more people to click to listen to this episode? So two different express needs, two different motivators, and two different things that they respond to in a way that gets you the results you're looking for.
Yeah, we talk about discovery a lot in the book. And I always say, you know, deals are not won at the presentation or the demonstration, but they're won in discovery, which means early on in the process, you're discovering, and you said it exactly right, the profile. And it's not just the profile of the company, right? Because most companies operate, whether they're centralized, decentralized, how they make decisions. Then within that company, the division of the person that you're, you know, selling to, what is the profile of that person? What is that person's, you know, decision makeup and criteria? And then, you know, we spend a lot of time analyzing the profiles or personas of these buyers. And, you know, it's hard to match the sales reps to the persona because, you know, once a certain sales rep has an account, they typically own the account. But the reality is that sales rep has to be a chameleon and understand that if I'm talking to a very detailed buyer, I better show up with spreadsheets and charts and the detail and not come in and talk about golf or fishing or whatever. And it's kind of the opposite. If you have kind of the buyer who's more emotionally oriented, you don't want to show up with, you know, stacks of spreadsheets. And so I think that's almost selling 101, but you'd be surprised how many people, you know, go in with, I have a hammer and there's the nail and I'm just going to use it in the same way I always use it and not really understand or discover, if you will, the situation or the profile or knowing your customer.
Hey, all you have to do is go on Facebook and accept friend requests from random people and you'll find out really quickly that the appointment setting industry all believes that everybody's looking to get 30 appointments a month. I'm not looking for 30 appointments a month. I'm looking for 10 closes a month. I honestly couldn't care less if I spoke with 10 people to get those 10 closes or spoke with 100 people to get those 10 closes. I prefer the 10, given my introverted nature, but I'm more concerned with getting the number of closes. Now, I could, on the other hand, be the type of buyer who is in a situation, this just occurred to me as I was listening to you, where they work in a culture where they need to fill out spreadsheets and pie charts and Venn diagrams and every other damn thing showing all these discrete metrics. And so they're looking to be able to say to whoever controls their funding that, yeah, we did hit our goal of having 50 scheduled appointments because that's what they're looking at. I worked for a temporary staffing industry for 8 months and 16 days. That's a whole nother story in itself. And the fact that I know exactly how long I was there is probably an indicator. But one thing, and this was around the year 1999, 2000, when we already had this whole thing where you could go on the internet and go to job boards and just reach out to everybody who's looking for a job, ask them what their skills were, and book in the ones that match the type of clients you're looking to fill temp positions for, bring them in so that they were on file when assignments came up. We were told we couldn't use a computer, and that was an ineffective way to do things. So one of my struggles was finding enough potential temps on board to fill the orders that were available. And the thing is, if you have a prospect in your files who's ready to go out on temp assignments, but you don't have a temp assignment for them in a reasonable period of time, which means if you're not getting a lot of clients in, you're not getting a lot of diversified clients in, what's going to happen is they're either going to find a permanent job or they're going to end up on another long-term temp assignment. You're going to lose them. Once you have that temp in your files ready to go on an assignment for you, you have a very limited window to actually put them on an assignment before they go somewhere else. So I was between a rock and a hard place. Now, what were my superiors primarily concerned with? The percentage of the day I spent on outgoing phone calls. So what I did to get them off my back, while I figured out innovative ways to get access to the computer so I could do what I knew would work anyway, is I would have my buddies call me and give me different phone numbers, what like at their work or at a pay booth or at a cell phone or something like that. And I would call back my buddies and have long conversations with them. And I got kudos, congratulations. I was celebrated in front of the entire company because my outgoing phone time was so high. But they never bothered to ask, who are these people you're speaking with?
Yeah, that's a great segue into the new book, right? I mean, the metrics that do matter, and a lot of people get tied up into, you know, having these metrics and checking boxes.
Uh-huh.
And the reality is, at the end of the day, you're only paid on results, right? So if that, those metrics do matter, then it makes sense. But if you're just trying to be, you know, putting phone calls on the board to be busy, you know, yeah, you may be busy, but you're not going to sell anything. So
right.
I think it's very, very important for, you know, people who are managing these metrics and, you know, setting up these processes to ensure that they really do deliver the objective. You know, and the objective is not to just have people do busy work. It's to have them do productive work to be able to generate revenue, right? Or opportunities.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, it's believe me, there's unfortunately a lot of organizations that are run on those kind of metrics, which is another reason why I think we, you know, tried to push this next book that really says, what are the metrics that do matter? And, you know, just because you have data doesn't mean it's the right data. And, you know, I think it's like anything else. There's a little bit of art, a little bit of science. There's much more science now, but it just can't be all science. And even artificial intelligence, you know, comes up with these wrong answers, right? It's just not, it's not as simple as, you know, make a lot of phone calls and you'll get a lot of appointments.
Yeah. So there's one more thing in the time we have left. And this is a really intriguing question to me, to the point that I almost don't even understand it. So I've been looking forward to our conversation just so I could ask this question. You mentioned, actually, I'm just going to ask the question. I'm going to let you guys answer it. And it's phrased as follows. Why is the end goal in SaaS sales sales if it's not closing?
Mark, I know you got a lot of, you know, grief on this one, so I'm going to give this one to you.
Yeah, no. So this kind of goes off of a couple articles that I've written, one of which is called Never Ever Close. And that is, so the concept is in SaaS, it's, you know, there isn't really a definitive close. There is a paper to, you know, a pen to paper. You know, or not even pen to paper, right? It's all DocuSign now. But there's that execution. And that's great. But that's not something to really celebrate, especially when you, in the SaaS world, always have an activation period. That for sure, that next 7 days, 30 days, 60 days, whatever it is, that's the most important time, because so many of these SaaS deals will get executed and then fall apart before the activation has started. And the activation being the implementation, getting a client up and running with this. So, and then we all know there's so much more work that has to be done around customer success and keeping clients happy past that 1 month period, 1 year period, and there. So I just like to remind, you know, people, mind the sales reps that I work with, that it's just not about a close. And even a hard sell kind of model, you know, it's not like you can't ask for a close. You can, but if you think you're going to change a time frame of an enterprise buyer and make them sign a deal for you, you know, a month and a half earlier than they want to, you're dreaming. And so many
if you got people like that, send them my way, we'll hire them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It doesn't happen.
It doesn't, but you still have lots of sales leaders who try to do that and try to get their sales team to make that happen. They know it's not going to happen with a high likelihood. But the point is that what they don't think of is how much damage they're doing to the account in the meantime. So that was the concept behind Never Ever Close.
Oh, I can translate that into terms that I understand. It's called the long game. I mean, my offer for working with entrepreneurs to launch your podcast is in, I like to call it the lower end of high ticket. It's a pretty substantial number, but there's a lot of value and a lot of moving parts in it. And I have a whole team behind me that supports it. And we have the ability to create a really great podcast in a relatively short period of time. And I also know that, that decision point is something that, I mean, candidly, one of the tides I fight against are the folks who still believe that if you just open up an account on iTunes and upload an audio, now I have a podcast. Well, first of all, it's called Apple Podcasts. It's not iTunes. iTunes is a software. Apple Podcasts is a platform. That's the first point. The second point is that's where podcasts go to die. I call it podcast purgatory in one of my own writings. Now, to convince somebody that that the investment in our Launch Your Podcast Fast program is what's most in alignment for them, despite the fact that it takes away most of the work they would have to do. They mostly have to answer questions and approve stuff and record some episodes so that it's all ready for the official launch and things of that nature. And we even provide the training if they think they don't know how to host. But believe me, hosting is not that big of a deal. It's actually a lot of fun. Yeah, sometimes people have to think about that and they say, yeah, I know, and I understand that you're actually taking 85 to 90% of the work out of my hands. And this isn't even something I have to get my team to fit into their schedule. This is awesome, but it's still an investment for me because now I'm going to have a podcast and I need to figure out how to put that into my organizational structure so that every week we're continuing to produce great episodes. Where are we finding guests? Where are we finding topics? When are we finding time to record? Now, I have the answers to all those questions, but the variable is, when are they ready to hear the answers and embrace them?
Yeah, that's awesome. That's awesome. Yeah. And that's it. It's exactly how, I mean, that fits perfectly into your model. And that's why you're as successful as you are doing what you do.
Well, yeah, certainly. And to me, that's just me taking something from an enterprise level and moving it down to, maybe pivoting it to the language that agencies like digital marketing agencies, boutique shops, may be dealing with when they're dealing with X number of clients, but it's not necessarily a big number, but it's a higher ticket number. So as I like to say, glaciers move a lot slower than pebbles, glaciers move a lot slower than hail pebbles, but they have a much bigger impact. Yeah, so what I want to do now, and I've loved this conversation, but we are at the top of the hour, is I do want to invite everybody to check out your book about selling the cloud, and it can be found on Amazon and other retailers such as that. And you have a great LinkedIn page about this, about selling the cloud. And I know that the book can also be found on Facebook and Twitter, and in the notes for people who come to our website, you'll see some other links as well to get the information. So the book is called Selling the Cloud, A Playbook for Success in Cloud Software and Enterprise Sales. And for those of you who've been listening to this the whole time, and even some of those who are just tuning in now, or those of you who kind of spaced out for 40 minutes that are now leaning in because worth the close, whatever, and need to go back and listen, which is fine. Happens to all of us. We've seen that there are some things you can look forward to in that book, looking at the different types of buyers, the different types of sales reps. We've looked into a definition of diversity. There are a lot of great things in this book. So whether you are actually selling the cloud or you're involved in artificial intelligence apps that you're looking to launch and sell, even other forms of business, there is a lot to learn in here. And I'm telling you, I'm going to put it on my virtual bookshelf and add it to my cigar time reading. So again, look up the book. It's called Selling the Cloud, A Playbook for Success in Cloud Software and Enterprise Sales by Mark Petruzzi and Paul Melchiori. Just look it up on the internet. They've got 1,000 links to it. You'll find it in 5 seconds. Read the book. And with that, Mark and Paul, thank you so much for being with us today. It's been an honor and, believe me, an education.
Thanks, Adam. Thank you so much.
Yep. Been awesome, Adam. Thank you.
We trust you enjoyed today's episode of the Business Creators Radio Show. Check out our previous and upcoming episodes on our website at www.businesscreatorsradioshow.com. While you're there, be sure to subscribe via your favorite network so you get fresh episodes delivered straight to you. Until next time, have a great day. Take care.